listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of They Beg His Pardon by Willem Marx. On January 20th, 2021, the final day of Trump's first term, Trump pardoned Republican fundraiser Elliot Broidy, whom Keller had prosecuted for violating foreign lobbyist rules. Senior Department of Justice officials had initially instructed the prosecuting team to pursue a lighter sentence against Broidy, says Keller. The DOJ did not respond to a request for comment. In January of Trump's second term, Keller had become acting chief of the Public Integrity Section, which focuses on corruption cases involving public office holders. But within weeks, Keller disagreed with the dismissal of corruption charges against then-New York Mayor Eric Adams, and he resigned. Since the start of 2025, the once-vaunted public integrity team has shrunk from some 30 prosecutors to just a handful. The rooms where it happened. Alexander Hamilton encouraged the framers to enshrine the concept of mercy in the Constitution. Many presidents have used Article II powers judiciously. John Adams pardoned participants in Freeze's Rebellion of 1800. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln pardoned many Union deserters. After it, Andrew Johnson blanket pardoned nearly all Confederate soldiers. Lincoln appointed a dedicated pardon clerk to deal with the huge flood of petitions stemming from the Civil War. There was a whole cottage industry of people who sprang up and were charging fees to get people pardons from President Lincoln because he was perceived to be a soft touch, says Samuel Morrison, a lawyer specializing in clemency cases. In those days, you could actually get a meeting with the president himself. It wasn't that hard to do. And so things went for the next century or so until Gerald Ford preemptively pardoned Richard Nixon. Then George H.W. Bush pardoned former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, who had been indicted for his role in the Iran-Contra affair. Then Bill Clinton offered 11th-hour reprieves to his half-brother Roger and Democrat superdonor Mark Rich. In the roughly quarter century since, the Office of the Pardon Attorney has employed a dedicated staff with a relatively established workflow. Those requesting a pardon have been required to wait 5 years after their conviction or sentence completion before submitting letters from at least three supporters and a long application. FBI background checks involve family members, neighbors, employers, equivalent to what you would need to get a top-secret security clearance, as one former pardon attorney put it. By the time Obama took office, the DOJ tightly controlled the process, says Morrison, who served 13 years in the pardon office until 2010. He says fellow bureaucrats stalled, sometimes hid, and occasionally lied about pardon applications. A couple of years after a 2012 report in the Washington Post highlighted such obfuscations, Obama launched a new clemency initiative focused on long sentences for drug-related offenses that led to more than 1,700 commutations. Yet in many states, the lives of convicted felons remain difficult when they receive only a commutation rather than a full pardon. Like millions of other formerly incarcerated people, they still live with what are known as civil disabilities. In certain states, some cannot earn a real estate license or work as a beautician. Others struggle to open investment accounts. Next photos: Rashawn Maddox, Paul Manafort, Mark Meadows, Kelly Meggs, Trevor Milton, Lorraine Pellegrino, Sidney Powell, Steve Stockman, Daryl Strawberry, Enrique Tarrio, Ross Ulbricht, Carlos Watson, Big Little Lies. Before his pardon, the OZ Media co-founder had been sentenced to 10 years for fraud. Christopher Worrell and Changping Zhao. Gimme, gimme more. The vast funds funneled into America's healthcare system each year through Medicare and Medicaid make the sprawling, complex, and fragmented industry uniquely susceptible to abuse. But even so, the scale of the $1.3 billion fraud scheme Philip Esformes perpetrated over more than a decade was breathtaking. He dispensed bribes liberally to doctors, sending patients to his facilities for occasionally inadequate care or unnecessary treatments, to a Florida state official who gave a heads up on inspections, and according to prosecutors, to a former University of Pennsylvania basketball coach who helped his son get into college. He lived in 11,000 square feet on Miami Beach, hired sex workers, lounged in luxury hotels, flew private, and cruised around in a $1.6 million Ferrari Aperta wearing a $360,000 Grubel Forsey watch. We had hours and hours of recordings, says Alan Medina, a prosecutor who oversaw Esformes' prosecution. The guy was just abusive. Convicted on 20 of an original 28 counts, Esformes was sentenced in September 2019 to 20 years and had to forfeit more than $38 million to the federal government and another $5.5 million in restitution to Medicare. Following his indictment, his family started donating tens of thousands of dollars to a Miami-based Jewish nonprofit called the Aleph Institute that advocates for prisoners' rights. Soon after his sentencing for a clemency campaign, and an Aleph-affiliated rabbi unsuccessfully asked the judge to let Esformes be placed in alternative supervision. An Aleph spokesperson says its advocacy for an alternative sentence for Mr. Esformes is among many hundreds of similar appeals, and that Aleph had returned the family's donations. With help from Dershowitz and support from other well-connected lawyers, including former Republican attorneys General Edwin Meese and Michael Mukasey, Esformes' campaign lasted little more than a year. By late December 2020, Medina, the prosecutor, was at his in-law's Massachusetts home for the holidays when a colleague messaged. A White House statement declared that Esformes would receive a commutation, shaving a decade off his sentence. "I couldn't believe what had happened," Medina tells Vanity Fair. "It was a punch in the gut." "This was a culmination of a lot of my career," he explains. "It was just disgusting." "I'll do it. I'll free him." In the weeks after the storming of the Capitol, Ahmed Basset worked close to 18-hour days at the FBI's Washington field office to help convict several of the most violent rioters. He later oversaw the contentious conviction of two D.C. police officers indicted on second-degree murder, conspiracy, and obstruction charges for a suspect's death in a high-speed chase. A fellow former prosecutor described that case as a total shit show for the bad blood it created among local law enforcement. After Trump resumed office in 2025, a DOJ colleague texted Basset, "Did you read this email? I'm really sorry." Hundreds of prosecutors had received a note from the new interim U.S. Attorney for D.C., Edward Martin, proudly announcing Trump had suddenly pardoned the two cops. Basset had prosecuted. What a great act by the president to protect our colleagues in these efforts to make D.C. safe, it read. Martin's official biography noted an internship on Pope John Paul II's staff. He tweeted after one pardon, "No MAGA left behind. then struggled to obtain Senate confirmation for the top prosecuting job in D.C. after several senators accused him of committing serious violations of professional conduct that undermines the integrity of our justice system. Former Fox News host Jeanine Pirro got the role instead. Bessette sat down in shock. I was astounded as he read Martin's missive. The decision was designed to blunt criticism of Trump, Bessette reasons, who had just 2 days earlier pardoned some of the cop-bashing Capitol rioters. But irony offered no consolation. 4 years of work and effort, in large respect, was just kind of wiped out with a couple signatures. The cops were not wealthy, but as law enforcement cause celeb, they'd attracted MAGA attention. Pardoning them re-upped the president's pro-cop persona. It's a question of what does the person have that Trump wants, according to Nick Ackerman, who helped prosecute the Watergate burglars in the 1970s. That's definitely the avenue that's being pursued in a lot of these cases. By November, Martin was DOJ's official pardon attorney, as he tweeted out dozens more grants, including for Giuliani, presidential senior advisor Boris Epstein, and another for former Trump lawyer Sidney Powell, ending what he called a grave national injustice done to their efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The January 6th rioters and the advocates who pushed to void their convictions seem to serve as a template for presidential loyalty, according to both supporters and critics. The pardons were sort of the trial balloon, in a sense, that he put up there to see what does that then trigger, says Bessette, who'd helped convict several far-right Oath Keepers militia members for assaulting police personnel and amassing a weapons arsenal as part of a quick reaction force. If you have my back, if you're loyal to me, like these J6 people, as Bessette imagines Trump thinking, you could beat up cops and I will go to bat for you. The Republican lobbyist who worked unsuccessfully to push Greg Lindbergh's clemency application forward under Trump 1.0 hadn't given up at the start of 2.0. The advice he's heard from administration officials involved in processing petitions today is simple. Do not relitigate your case. Better, he says, to focus on prosecutors' weaponization of the law. It will likely resonate with this president. If you have evidence, for lack of a better word, or justification for the idea that your entire case only existed because they were on a political witch hunt, he told me, that's different. Ross Ulbricht was a Texan, Eagle Scout, physics graduate, and Ron Paul supporter who built and secretly ran Silk Road, the sprawling global dark web bazaar. In 2015, he received two life sentences, plus a further 40 years for narcotics trafficking, among other charges, and was ordered to forfeit around $180 million. The presiding judge suggested Ulbricht's punishment should deter criminality in a new era of online commerce, but many supporters considered it draconian, pointing to the comparatively mild treatment of Sinaloa cartel boss Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, who received just a single life sentence, plus 30 years, in 2019. How do you make sense of one life sentence for that man, but two for Ross? Asked Martha Bueno, a Florida libertarian outraged by Ulbricht's treatment. Not long after the sentencing, Bueno began helping Ulbricht's mother, Lynn, a septuagenarian retiree, plunging headfirst into saving her son. Lynn became like Frodo Baggins from Lord of the Rings, Bueno says, traveling the country, pleading for mercy with congressmen, senators, and business leaders. Her case was never, "This is wrong because the United States government is wrong," Bueno told Vanity Fair. It was always, "My son doesn't deserve to be there. He's already repented during his trial." Over the years, whenever Ulbricht was transferred to a new prison, Lynn moved to a nearby city. Ulbricht's clemency petition moved close to Trump's desk during his first term, but never received a final sign-off, according to Bueno. Lynn was devastated, absolutely devastated, She had put all of her hope into Trump pardoning her son. He didn't do it, and she spent the next 4 years trying to find any way into the Biden administration. But Biden's team had no interest whatsoever, despite the best efforts of Ulbricht's pardon attorneys, slews of letters, including from lawmakers, and hundreds of thousands of signatures from supporters, including Bitcoin advocates and libertarians. They just locked this guy up, made him sound like a supervillain, says Angela McArdle, a former chair of the U.S. Libertarian Party. The sentence was terrifying. But by November 2023, hope glimmered again when McArdle received a surprise call from Richard Grenell, Trump's former director of national intelligence, asking what libertarians thought of the twice-impeached former president who was once more mulling a run. The two agreed to meet, and at a restaurant in Austin, Trump called Grenell's cell phone and spoke with McArdle for some 45 minutes. "As the chair of another political party, I can't literally endorse you," she says she told him, "but I can help you figure out how to appeal to libertarians and try to get the broader libertarian vote." The following month, McArdle was at Mar-a-Lago to meet Trump in person. "I walked in with an index card and a book for him to autograph." Trump arrived late, having flown down from New York, where he'd spent the day testifying in his civil fraud trial. He hugged McArdle before sitting down to dinner with her, her husband, a couple of staffers, and Grenell, who had counseled her to negotiate the terms of any political support. As Trump dined on well-done steak with ketchup and Diet Coke, the group discussed fentanyl, cannabis, and monetary policy. Then McArdle, in a cold, nervous sweat, made her ask. Though she knew it might doom her own future with Libertarian Party members, she suggested Trump attend their convention the following year. "If you come and you walk out on stage and you agree to freeing Ross Ulbricht," she told him, "everyone is going to scream, they're going to lose their minds, and they're all going to vote for you." Trump responded by asking, "Who's Ross Ulbricht?" before assenting, "I'll do it. I'll free him." McArdle kept this plan secret for months, then extended official convention invitations to both Trump and Biden, whose team acknowledged receipt, but who did not attend. Trump marched out to a smattering of boos, but when he mentioned Ulbricht, the boos, as promised, turned to hysterical cheers. In every picture you see of Trump at that convention, you saw a free Ross sign somewhere in it, recalls Bueno. On just his second day of his second term, Trump announced on social media that he called Lynn Ulbricht to confirm her son's pardon. The pardon attorney's team had no official paperwork to show Ulbricht's prison warden he should be freed. Everything is a nail. High-profile clemency lobbyists have seen a hugely profitable business develop since then, to the shock of those who support a traditional process. "It's just a feeding frenzy," former pardon attorney Liz Oyer tells Vanity Fair. Clemency has been a way that numerous people who are in Trump's inner circle and beyond have been able to enrich themselves. They're dealing with people who are often really pretty desperate to be considered for clemency. And so they have the ability to charge huge sums of money just based on promises of the possibility of clemency without any guarantees. Oyer, pardon attorney until early 2025, was ejected from the Department of Justice after refusing to obey what she considered an inappropriate instruction from a political appointee to recommend reinstating gun rights. Mel Gibson had lost after a misdemeanor domestic violence conviction. Mel Gibson's gun rights were restored in spring of 2025. For certain defendants, a pardon is not just about avoiding prison. Some owe millions of dollars in restitution payments or asset forfeiture and will spend big to have a flick of the presidential pen cancel those debts. For Carlos Watson, founder of once buzzy digital startup Ozy Media, that meant about $1 million up front for his appeal, bail pending appeal, and a clemency package to be handled by the New York law firm of Arthur Idala, who has represented Harvey Weinstein, Anthony Weiner, and Roger Ailes. In July 2024, the feds convicted Watson of wire fraud and securities fraud conspiracies, as well as defrauding investors through identity theft. His COO had impersonated a YouTube executive on a due diligence call with Goldman Sachs. Together with Ozzy as a corporate defendant, Watson was ordered to pay approximately $37 million in restitution to victims and nearly $60 million in forfeiture to the U.S. government. Idala and other attorneys helped craft the clemency application package. Two people familiar with Watson's case say Idala's team sought help from high-profile individuals like Steve Bannon, another Idala client. Trump pardoned Bannon, his former chief strategist, in the final moments of his first term, forcing federal prosecutors to drop their case against him. The Manhattan District Attorney later filed charges against Bannon for skimming funds raised during a campaign to build a wall on the Mexican border. In that case, Idala advised Bannon to plead guilty to a single felony count, thus avoiding prison time. Idala declined to comment. But for Watson, time was short, with a 10-year sentence in a California prison slated to start last March. Soon after Trump returned to the White House, advocates for Watson's clemency realized the pardon attorney's office needed bypassing. "If it's not in the White House, it's just not real. It's not happening," says one person who agreed to help Watson. "When you look at paperwork and you see United States government against you, you can't match that energy," this person tells Vanity Fair. "There's a reason they rarely ever lose." Prosecutors, the supporter believes, work in a culture that's taught them being a hammer and recognizing everything as a nail is the approach that will get them rewarded career-wise. Hoping to flood the zone, the same supporter contacted previous pardon recipients. "The more hooks you have in the water, the more fish you're going to end up catching." They spent money boosting messages about Watson on X to users tweeting about lawfare and justice. The messages were written, thanks to ChatGPT, in language that matches President Trump's rhetoric about these issues, this person tells Vanity Fair. "The gift my mother gave me, I guess, is the ability to read people and figure out where power lives and how to motivate power in the right direction. How do you get to Bannon? How do you get to Dershowitz?" Dershowitz, who'd consulted on Esforme's case, was useful since his work during Trump's first impeachment had endeared him to the president. "One of the jobs of a lawyer is to understand how the process works in each particular administration at any given time, and that's what I've been advising clients on," Dershowitz tells Vanity Fair. "Every administration looks at the executive clemency decision somewhat differently. Some have more formal processes. Some have less formal processes." By late March, the cogs were turning in Watson's favor, though the outcome remained uncertain. He flew from D.C. to California to surrender himself. Then, just 90 minutes away from prison, he received what one person involved in the clemency effort termed a commutation plus. He'd avoid serving time, but also skip out on the $96 million in restitution and forfeiture. Months later, the Securities and Exchange Commission also dropped its separate civil enforcement action against Watson. Thanks to its constitutional provenance, presidential pardon power faces little legal circumscription and minimal disclosure requirements for clemency advocacy efforts. There are also no federal laws that prohibit individuals, including presidential associates or advisors, from accepting money in return for pardon lobbying. As one clemency advocate advises of the traditional pardon process, "If you can afford it, just effing skip it." If the president himself received explicit offers of personal payment, that might justify an investigation into potential bribery law violations, legal experts say. But after a 2024 Supreme Court decision made official presidential acts safe from prosecution, impeachment remains the only, unlikely given the current Congress, consequence. He could just openly say, you know, $50 million into my bank account, and I'll give you a pardon, jokes Peter Zeidenberg, an attorney who's recently worked with the fugees Price Michelle and once helped prosecute I. Lewis Scooter Libby, who once worked on Mark Rich's case. The Supreme Court has basically said, yeah, you got immunity. In her dissenting opinion, Justice Sonia Sotomayor highlighted how a president's receipt of bribes in return for pardons would, as an official duty, be rendered immune. It made the president, she wrote, king above the law. Only a constitutional amendment could now circumscribe the pardon power, according to Barbara McQuaid, a former federal prosecutor and now University of Michigan law professor. But such a bipartisan act is unthinkable. As a prosecutor, McQuaid says she always equated presidential pardons with forgiveness. Just before Trump left office in 2021, he commuted the sentence of former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, whom McQuaid had convicted on 24 counts, including wire fraud, mail fraud, and racketeering. It didn't feel like a decision driven by compassion. It struck her as an insult to the public. In the pardon context, she says, the discrepancy between the haves and the have-nots was typically the quality of their applications, with the wealthy pointing to charitable donations and public good works. What feels different now is an appearance that people are actually buying access. Princeton law professor Deborah Perlstein agrees it's becoming a sales job. We're going to set up a pardon vending machine, and if you put the right gold coin in it, you can get one. Free and clean. Reality TV performer Todd Chrisley, star of USA Network's Chrisley Knows Best, was showering at the Beverly Hills Four Seasons in August 2019 when his wife, Julie, interrupted to hand him a cell phone with his attorneys on the line. He was being indicted. Chrisley finished his shower, then flew with Julie to Atlanta, where deputy U.S. Marshals photographed the surrendering pair in the Fulton County Courthouse, then escorted them upstairs to a judge's chambers. Prosecutors initially argued bail should be denied. The Chrisleys were so rich they might flee. They ultimately requested a bond of just $250,000 for him. Such a low amount, Chrisley recalls thinking, it surely undermined claims about their abundant wealth. He bonded at $100,000. What started with an approximately $3 million tax evasion accusation in Georgia and a raid on a warehouse filled with Chrisley family furniture had by then metastasized into an IRS case that drew in the U.S. Attorney's Office for Georgia's Northern District. According to Chrisley, a former judge told his legal team that the prosecutor had been looking for a big fish to catch in Georgia, and that the Chrisleys were the biggest fish that Georgia had at that time. The couple eventually owed less than $100,000 in unpaid taxes to the Georgia Department of Revenue. They filed a civil lawsuit against that department's special investigator. The department settled and acknowledged aspects of its initial investigation had been unethical and against policy. However, the Chrisleys' former business manager turned against them, and their accountant was shown to be less than accomplished. Chrisley says federal prosecutors threatened to indict two of their young adult children, as well as his 70-something-year-old mother, if he did not accept a plea deal. Julie was devastated, Chrisley tells Vanity Fair. I had started to become pissed off. Both husband and wife were eventually sentenced to 12 and 7 years, respectively. We had been together for 30 years and had never spent a night away from each other, recalls Chrisley, who didn't speak to Julie by phone for more than 2 years, but still found that first night apart the hardest. I was so angry at God because I kept saying, God wouldn't allow this to happen. and I cried myself to sleep. After the verdict, his daughter Savannah spent $460,000 to hire Alex Little from the Tennessee law firm of Litson to navigate an appeal and potential pardon petition. Having previously worked at the International Criminal Court and former President Jimmy Carter's peace initiatives in Africa, with a brief stint as a CIA analyst, Little was not an obvious choice to build a powerful network among MAGA Republicans. But his work on a case involving Amazon had seemingly impressed Jim Trusty, who later defended Trump against charges of mishandling classified documents. And during Little's defense of Brian Kelsey, a Tennessee state senator charged with violating campaign finance laws, he encountered David Warrington, who also worked for Kelsey and subsequently became Trump's White House counsel. After Trump resumed power, Little submitted a clemency petition for Kelsey, who was pardoned just weeks after his sentence began. Little, long an appeals lawyer, quickly became a pardon-focused attorney, telling Vanity Fair the real problems in Chrisley's original conviction appeared unusual in such a high-profile prosecution. Going into the appellate argument, we had very, very strong cases on multiple fronts. As we sort of click off the contingencies, it's like being a pilot, explains Little. Where's the first place you're going to land? If that place doesn't work, where's the second place you're going to land? If you got to land in a field, you got to land in a field. But we're going to get you home safe. But Todd Chrisley's appeal looked set to drag on, and Savannah grew impatient. She started working the phones, pleading her parents' innocence, even speaking at the 2024 Republican National Convention about rogue prosecutors and the Democrats' corruption. After more than 2 years in prison and $4.2 million in legal fees, Chrisley himself grew used to his life inside. He secretly used multiple cell phones, enjoyed a large commissary account, and thanks to his influence in education, developed an intense desire to push back against the capriciousness, incompetence, and occasional cruelty of prison authorities. Eventually, Savannah's appeals to Trump bore fruit. A video from late last May shows Trump on an Oval Office speakerphone, informing her that within a day, her parents would be free and clean after their harsh treatment. Hours later, the legal nightmare that began for Chrisley at a luxury Los Angeles hotel ended in a Pensacola, Florida prison. He handed other prisoners all his spare gear. You're only allowed to have 2 pairs of tennis shoes. I had 7. You're only allowed to have 2 sweatsuits. I had 11. You're only allowed to spend $360 a month on commissary. I spent $2,000. And walked out. While inside, he'd pushed to see his prison camp shuttered, and he now says improving inmate conditions and reducing America's recidivism rate has provided him with a purpose-driven life. The presidential pardon power can right a wrong and gives those that are incarcerated hope. Chrisley told Vanity Fair, President Trump has been the answer to a lot of people's hope in this country. The fact that his pardoner is himself a convicted felon helps, too. the homeland. Renee Good and Alex Preddy were labeled domestic terrorists, rhetoric employed by the Trump administration to justify the state taking life by associating the dead with national villainy. Opening illustration, Life and Liberty, the DHS posted American Progress by John Gast, writing, "A heritage to be proud of, a homeland worth defending." And the picture looks like the entire history of Americans going west by various methods of transportation. In the wake of poet and writer Renee Good's killing, Donald Trump and his collaborators have done all they can to define her as an enemy of the homeland. The administration claims, for instance, that Good was a domestic terrorist, a term it applied to Alex Preddy, the ICU nurse whom federal agents killed less than 3 weeks later. This rhetoric is employed to justify the state taking life by associating the dead with national villainy. But the campaign against Good is different, because the homeland takes particular and perverse interest in women deemed insufficiently reverent of hearth and home. Trump propagandists tell us that Good was part of a growing cabal of insolent white ladies turned violent, that she was a lesbian agitator in league with 68 IQ Somali scammers, or that she was simply, as her killer apparently labeled her, an effing bitch. For these and other sins, her castigation has extended into the afterlife. With Elon Musk AI tool Grok, users churned out deepfakes of Good with bullets in her head and of her corpse in a bikini. This is all appropriate. In defending the undocumented, Good violated the sanctity of the homeland, which is to say that she questioned the divine promise of American soil to a mythical and singular people. For the homeland is not the state or even the country. The homeland is not defined by simple geography. It exists beyond laws and norms. It is unconcerned with traditional American concepts like liberty, freedom, or pluralism. The homeland is that piece of earth providentially deeded to the Volk. The homeland's borders are drawn in untainted blood, its sanctity exemplified in proper gender conduct and the fulfillment of gender roles. It is the homeland that ICE venerates in its recruitment post, festooned with victorious white settlers and vanquished indigenous Americans. It is the homeland that Musk saluted twice at Trump's inauguration. It is the homeland that the late Charlie Kirk was fond of invoking. "I want to be able to get married, buy a home, have kids, allow them to ride their bike till the sun goes down, send them to a good school, have a low-crime neighborhood, not to have my kids be taught the lesbian, gay, transgender garbage in their school, while also not having them have to hear the Muslim call to prayer 5 times a day. It is often said that the homeland is skeptical of immigrants, but more precisely, the homeland is skeptical of aliens. Asylum seekers from Gaza fleeing a genocide have no place in the homeland. Afrikaners suffering the indignity of post-apartheid are welcome. The homeland is covetous of northern Europeans, but regards Somali Americans as garbage. Why can't we have some people from Norway, Sweden, just a few?" Trump recently said. "But we always take people from Somalia, places that are a disaster, right? Filthy, dirty, disgusting, ridden with crime." The criteria for these distinctions between putative immigrant and indelible alien are not complicated. For above all, the homeland is a racist project. Securing the homeland is the central feature of the Trump administration. In Los Angeles and Chicago, Trump seeks to cleanse it. With Greenland and Venezuela, Trump seeks to expand and enrich it. Heterosexual men are the rightful defenders of the homeland. Lesbian agitators such as Good are its nemesis. Christians are the lifeblood of the homeland. Stupid Muslims are its cancer. A characteristic of the homeland is that its foes must be subhuman, Members of the LGBTQ plus community are freaks, disagreeable women are ugly pigs, and the residents of D.C. are cockroaches. For years, a certain kind of liberal has either minimized such culture war rhetoric coming from the other side or urged political actors of all stripes to ignore it in favor of material or kitchen table issues. As though the state regarding one's life as garbage has no tangible consequence, as if the terms of a fight can be determined by the person getting punched. But Trump has clarified an inconvenient fact. The culture war is an actual war. ICE, full of myrmidons of the homeland, enjoys an $85 billion budget, a sum larger than the annual military budget of every country in the world except the United States and China, as Caitlin Dickerson reported in The Atlantic. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, just one component of the Department of Homeland Security, is getting more money than any other law enforcement agency in America. Deportations are up under Trump, but that is not the true purpose of ICE. They're not serious about getting rid of as many people as they can. They're serious about causing human pain and suffering, a former ICE official told Dickerson. Putting someone into detention isn't a removal, it's a punishment. 32 people died in ICE's custody in 2025, the highest number in 20 years, and befitting an administration filled with reality TV stars, a policy of human pain and suffering is presently being repackaged as spectacle. Activists arrested in defiance of the homeland have had their portraits altered via AI. Minor celebrities, their dubious status on the wane, have sought to supercharge their prospects by accompanying ICE on raids or even joining its ranks. Kristi Noem, the head of the Department of Homeland Security, posed in front of a group of immigrants sent to a torture site in El Salvador in a show of sadistic titillation. Last June, L.A. County Supervisor Janice Hahn watched as Noem led an ICE raid in Huntington Park. I could tell she was doing a full camera crew production, Hahn said. She was getting hair and makeup done. Noem, like the president she serves, has a flair for the theatrical. She cosplays in camouflage and bulletproof vest. The focus on appearance and production value is essential in a movement that seeks not just to purify the actual America, but to resurrect the America of legend and myth. Securing the homeland, they tell us, is an existential priority. It is also content. Many Americans, horrified by the homeland's agents rampaging through whole communities, seizing children, perp-walking half-naked old men, and detaining whomever they feel like, with or without charges, all while enjoying absolute immunity, have settled on an interesting term, occupation. This designation is as correct as it is unoriginal, a fact more Americans would do well to remember. ICE has contracted surveillance tools that, according to Joseph Cox at 404 Media, allow it to track phones without a warrant and follow their owners home or to their employer. These tools, reportedly deployed across Minneapolis, were not created in America, but in Israel, still another homeland enforcing the longest occupation in modern history. Thus, the people of Minnesota have, as American taxpayers, subsidized an occupation overseas that is effectively a laboratory for their own. We did not blindly stumble into this era of homeland rule. Almost 25 years ago, when the Department of Homeland Security was first proposed, there were inklings, even among supporters, that things might someday come to this. Homeland isn't really an American word, Peggy Noonan wrote in the Wall Street Journal in 2002. She supported the formation of the department, but something bothered her about the name. It's not something we used to say or say now. It has a vaguely Teutonic ring. We must help the Führer protect the homeland. Blogger Mickey Kaus, writing for Slate that year, echoed Noonan's concerns. noting that the proposed department name explicitly ties our sentiments to the land, not to our ideas. Russell Feingold, who was the junior Wisconsin senator at the time, saw something more substantive at work. Feingold saw gaps in the legislation that a would-be tyrant could easily exploit. A figure like that would be completely lacking in virtue. And Feingold's colleagues could not imagine that the American people, in their infinite wisdom, would allow such an arch-villain to ascend to the presidency. People said, "Russ, no president would do X, Y, or Z," Feingold recently told me. In other words, the norms are strong enough that you're just sort of a Cassandra. Feingold was the lone Senate vote against the Patriot Act, and one of only 9 senators to oppose the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. Feingold watched with alarm as, in the wake of 9/11, the country's immigration policy was subsumed by counterterrorism. As soon as 9/11 occurred, within seconds, it became clear that the Bush administration was going to target Muslims and Arab Americans, Feingold said. Indeed, over a period of months, the FBI detained 762 undocumented immigrants, mostly from Muslim or Arab countries, as persons of interest. The Department of Justice's Office of the Inspector General later reported that detainment could result from something as simple as a landlord reporting suspicious activity by an Arab tenant, or possession of suspicious items, such as pictures of the World Trade Center and other famous buildings. These men were held for weeks or months, with some denied contact with legal representatives, some physically abused, and some put on 23-hour lockdown. Most were deported, and despite being investigated in the wake of 9/11, none were ever charged with anything related to terrorism. In 2008, after Barack Obama won the Democratic primary, Feingold began to see another older trend emerge, one that is foundational to the homeland mythos. While in the Senate, Feingold made a point to hold town meetings in all 72 of Wisconsin's counties. The meetings were, by his telling, pretty mellow, filled with supporters and few conservatives. They were always civil, Feingold said. And then Obama is elected, and I start going to these last 15 or so town meetings, and it was unbelievable. The guy wasn't even sworn in yet. And all of a sudden, all these people started coming, a kind of tough-looking crowd, and booing, and saying, "He's a socialist. He wasn't born in the United States. He's going to do this, he's going to do that." And there was fire in their eyes. And it was very strange, because Obama had won many of these counties in the rural areas, and yet there was this thing that was happening. When pundits later tried to chalk up the growth of the Tea Party, then Trump's first election, to economic anxiety and a snubbed working class, Feingold was skeptical. There was this whole dynamic that coalesced into this sort of feeling of white people being under siege, Feingold said. That, to me, is sort of the political context that opens the door. But skeptical as he was, Feingold never saw things advancing this far. He lost his 2010 re-election bid to Republican Ron Johnson, a Trump ally, who remains in office and has blamed Goods and Preddy's deaths on Democrats' incitement of violence and obstruction against federal law enforcement. "I'll be the first to admit the reason I did it was because I feared that someday there could be somebody who would do some of these things in an abusive way," Feingold said of his voice against the DHS. "But I never imagined that there would be somebody who would do all of these things at every opportunity." The problem will almost certainly outlive Trump's presidency. ICE's budget has steadily increased through Democratic and Republican administrations. That funding has gone to what journalist Radley Balko calls the most rogue, renegade, and certainly pro-Trump police agency in the federal government. No matter who wins the midterms this year or the presidential election in 2028, the Army of the Homeland will remain, and its enemies in the Democratic Party seem to have little desire to fight back. And so then, it falls to the people themselves. In these moments, I find comfort and inspiration in ancestors and martyrs. More than half a century ago, as the writer Jelani Cobb recently noted, activist Viola Liuzzo, a housewife and mother of five, left her family in Detroit and headed south to join the march to Montgomery, and in the process left the privileges of white ladyhood behind. For transgressing against the homeland of that era, the neo-Confederate South, Liuzzo was murdered by white supremacists. Justice Good was slandered by the homeland's authorities as a domestic terrorist and an effing bitch. Liuzzo was slandered by the homeland's rulers as a heroin addict and nymphomaniac who'd gone south to make a cuckold of her husband. But the slander was itself revelatory, for it demonstrated the homeland's perverse, exacting norms, its obsession with hierarchy, its rigid borders, and the high price levied on anyone who dared cross them. Forces of the neo-Confederate South did not simply represent a threat to African Americans, as was the popular perception, Cobb wrote. They were a mortal danger to anyone who disagreed with them, regardless of the person's race, background, or gender. Perhaps we are in such a moment now, where a death demonstrates to the country the broad nature of the threat. But this is a passive hope, and in Liuzzo's life, we find a more active call to action. Liuzzo was born into poverty. Her father was a coal miner, her husband a union organizer. Hers was the kind of salt-of-the-earth family often celebrated in the anthems of the homeland. Whereas the homeland sees freedom as the sole prerogative of its tribe, Liuzzo's vision extended to humanity itself. While understanding the economic exploitation of her family, she also understood that whiteness had enrolled her in the exploitation of others. When Liuzzo acquired this knowledge, when she got woke, she was transfigured into a traitor to her race and a menace to the homeland. For being a menace, for being woke, she was killed, as was Renee Good, as was Alex Preddy. But revelations have their blessings, too. In this case, a life, however brief, that is clean and does not depend on the oppression and debasement of others, the revelation of deep human ties, the belief that we are all equally chosen, doomed Liuzzo, Good, and Preddy, as revelation so often does. But it also immortalized them. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Or you can ask your smart speaker to play North Carolina Reading Service. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.